Accession number 28353, Reel 2.
Peter, we were discussing the weather at Valley, but I think we can move on now from that.
Indeed, and I moved on from Valley at that stage to Chivna, but before doing so, I had about 9 months to wait for my course, and I was attached to an Air Experience flight flying out of Filton near Bristol, taking young Air Training Corps cadets and young Combined Cadet Force cadets for 20-minute, 30-minute Air Experience flights, and actually that was a very enjoyable summer, and I often look back on that particular summer of 67 with great great fun. But the next serious part of my career was at Chivna, where I learnt to fly the Hunter, which was to be the aircraft of my first operational tour. Chivna was a great place, great spirit. The aeroplane was just what I expected it to be. The course was tough, demanding, more applied flying now as opposed to pure flying, and I did well enough to get through it, although I don't think, again, I was perhaps as high on the order of merit, as it were, at the end of the course as I had been at Valley on the NAT.
What's the difference between applied flying and...
Well, applied flying, weaponry, air-to-ground weaponry, air-to-air weaponry, low-level navigation, carrying out simulated attacks against simulated targets. So as opposed to pure flying, which would be something like aerobatics, circuit work, instrument flying, things of that nature. So the actual application of the aircraft in an operational function.
Thank you.
There were six of us on my course at Chivna, all looking to go on to operational Hunter squadrons, and towards the end of the course we were told that there would be two slots in the Far East in Singapore, two slots in the Middle East at Sharjah, and two slots on the UK based squadrons at West Raynham, and would we please nominate where we wished to go. And I thought, well, this is going to be difficult. Not difficult for me to choose where I wanted to go, but surely all six of us are going to want to go to Singapore. I mean, they must do, mustn't they? But I put down my choice, and so did obviously everybody else. And as it turned out, two people, the two married officers on our course, wanted to go to West Raynham. Two of our bachelors wanted to go to Sharjah in the Middle East. And two of us wanted to go to Singapore, which was extraordinary. And the Air Force didn't change any of those, and we actually all went where we wanted to go. So I was absolutely cock-a-hoop about that. My father had served in Singapore in the 30s. He'd been flying short Singapores in Singapore from Salita. And his tales of life in the 30s in Singapore were very attractive indeed, and so that was why I wanted to get out there. Apart from which, although I don't think we had got the sort of the announcement of the withdrawal from East of Suez at that stage, I think the writing was probably on the wall, and this was going to be perhaps the last opportunity of getting to that part of the world in an operational capacity. So I arrived in Singapore in March of 1968, and I will always remember my arrival interview. I arrived with a great chum, this colleague on the course, called Ian Ward, who I've maintained a close friendship with ever since, and on morning number one we were invited to tip up at the station commander's office for an arrival interview. The station commander was a South African who had a very fierce reputation, a chap called Largesson, Phil Largesson. Reputation that he would go round the station from time to time with a bullwhip, which he would crack to encourage people to work hard and play hard. But he certainly was an interesting and charismatic man. we arrived in his office, smartly dressed as flying officers, and I was on his right as he looked at us, and he held out his hand, and I shook that, said, "Good morning, sir." Ian, who was on my right, put out his hand, whereupon Phil Largson just clenched his fist and punched him straight in the stomach, quite hard, and said, "Right, you two," in his broad South African twang, "if you're not combat ready in 6 months, I'll ship you home. End of interview." And that was our arrival interview. Well, we both made combat ready within 6 months, so we weren't shipped home. But again, I think a wonderful first tour for a young man. In relative terms to what we expect of our youngsters these days, there's no doubt in my mind that it was a flying club. I mean, we thought we were doing an important job of work. There wasn't really a great threat. The confrontation with Indonesia was over by that stage. Frankly, as a day fighter, the Hunter was now starting to be dated, and there were lightnings in theatre who could do the job better than we could. We had a ground attack capability, but our primary weapon was a 3-inch unguided rocket with a gravity drop which was huge, and therefore you weren't going to do an enormous amount of damage, well, certainly not precision damage to the targets on the ground. We trained quite hard, but as I say, I think in terms of what we now expect our youngsters to do, it was something of a flying club. Great fun, huge fun, with opportunities again to play a great deal of sport, to be involved as president of the was keen to further out there. The second thing which sort of came my way out there in the flying side was that when 207 Squadron disbanded from Salita, which had been a pioneer squadron with both twin and single engine pioneers, when it disbanded, I suppose about the back end of 68, it passed on to 20 Squadron, its last four single engine pioneers, and so we formed a third flight. We had two flights, and we were a big squadron, a squadron of some 24 aircraft, and I was the 31st pilot on the squadron, so a big squadron. And so we had two flights of Hunters, and we had a flight of single engine pioneers, and some people were selected to fly those as well, and I was one of those and spent 6 months flying predominantly the single engine pioneer, although we also used to fly some 8 hours or so a month in the Hunter as well to keep our hands in. The role of the single engine pioneer was to act as an airborne forward air controller, and we trained for that, and that actually was quite a demanding role because you had to fly the aircraft and do all the planning at the same time. So you would get airborne with a briefcase full of maps, rulers, pencils, briefing sheets, fly the aircraft to the target area, plan the attack on your knee with ruler and map and stopwatch and things of that nature. Then you would brief the Canberra or the Hunter that was going to carry out the simulated attack, and then the attack would be mounted, either with you marking it with smoke or just trying to talk the fighter onto the target itself. So it was actually quite demanding to fly the aircraft and do the planning and the briefing at the same time. And although that was our primary job, we did also spend an awful lot of time just taking the aircraft round all the little strips in West Malaysia. And there were not hundreds of strips, but there certainly would have been 50 different strips in West Malaysia, right the way up through the country, up to the Thai border in the north, where the Malay police had some forts in the mountains there, where they were conducting a counter-terrorist operation against the communists up on the Thai border.
And so that was still going on then?
That was still going on, yes. That was certainly going on still. And we would fly in there, support them, take resupply and things of that nature in there, exchange second-hand books and cases of beer for blowpipes and things of that nature. And that was great fun. And I think The one real advantage that I derived out of those 6 months of flying that little aeroplane was, A, the experience of flying a tailwheel aeroplane again in some quite demanding conditions in and out of these mountain strips, but being sent off as a youngster with an aeroplane for a week or 10 days by the boss, who say, take the aeroplane off, go up to the Thai border, land at as many places you can possibly land in, bring the aeroplane back, hopefully serviceable at the end of the week, and then we'll, you know, talk about what you're going to do next week. And to do that with probably just one flight line mechanic or something of that nature to help you refuel the aeroplane, do these sort of servicing between flights and so forth, was a great experience in teaching you to be responsible, to teaching you to be independent, use your own initiative, think for yourself. And it's the sort of experience that our young helicopter crews get these days. And I think it's one of the reasons why you see that quite a lot of people with helicopter experience develop leadership skills which those in perhaps the more rarefied fast jet world don't necessarily do so, because again they have had the experience from a very early age of going off on their own with an aeroplane, responsible for it, responsible for men as well, in as much as they take their ground crew with them and so forth. And I think the single engine pioneer gave me an introduction to that particular aspect of leadership as a young officer in the service. I was able then to get it even more so as a flight commander on a Harrier squadron, and I'll talk about that. But I think there is a great advantage in operating in that sort of environment than, for example, youngsters who did nothing but go to the Vulcan Force or something of that nature. Yes, they were very competent air crew, but they hadn't got the experience as young officers of having responsibility for airmen under their command. And I think I was just lucky to have that experience. So for me, the single engine pioneer was a very useful hook on which to learn certain skills and perhaps attributes which serve me in good stead at a later stage.
What actual support work did you do then for the Malay police with the Pioneer?
Just take spares in, take provisions in and things of that nature. And it was a very informal relationship. We weren't being tasked specifically by the Malays to do that, but because it was our job to go round and make sure that all these strips were open, because the Malays didn't have any fixed-wing aeroplanes themselves at that stage. They'd got rid of their Pioneers. And therefore we were the only people who could do that. That was part of our formal task. But, of course, if you met a fort commander who said, hey, you know, when you come back next time, can you bring this or that, then we'd clearly do so. One of the things I did one day for the... They had an aborigine out of the jungle in the area of a place called Fort Kimar, and they said, would I take him to the dentist in Kuala Lumpur on my way back to Singapore? So I said, yes, of course I would. I hadn't seen the chap at this stage, and I had lunch at Fort Kimar, and they said, oh, he'll be out of the aeroplane when you get out. Well, when we got outside to the aeroplane, there was this small man who would have been probably less than 5 feet, he was aboriginal in dimension, dressed only in a loincloth and all his possessions that he needed for this journey in a knapsack. I don't suppose he had ever seen an aeroplane, let alone fly in one, and we put him in, because there were four little seats behind the pilot seat, we put him in one of these, and he sat throughout the sortie with his shoulders up round his head, so there appeared to be no neck, and his eyes just kept sort of moving from left to right, but his head didn't. We flew him down to Kuala Lumpur, where we needed to land at the military airfield. There were two airfields in Kuala Lumpur, civil and military. It was pouring with rain, absolutely torrential rain. We found the airfield by flying to the civil one, finding a tall block of flats, and knowing that if we went up the block from the road, from the block of flats, we'd find the military airfield, landed on that, taxied as close to the terminal building as I could get the aircraft, opened the door, and my last memory of this chap was seeing him running with his bare feet and loincloth across this airfield dispersal to the terminal building, was absolutely pouring with rain. How he ever got back to Fort Kemar, which was an hour by air away from it, I have no idea, but he was going to the dentist. And so that was one way, for example, which we sort of used to help these people from time to time. But in other ways, we used to sort of take some spares and say then if they wanted books and beer and things of that nature, we would do that.
So
as well.
No direct military assistance against the...
No, we weren't involved in the operation against. That was their responsibility. We just sort of took supplies and things of that nature in for them. But no, we weren't involved in spotting or anything of that nature for that particular operation. No.
Right.
After I had been on the squadron for about 9 months, my good friend there, Group Captain Largson, called me in and said that I was going to be interviewed, or my name had been put forward, to go off and be an ADC to the Commander-in-Chief of the Far East Air Force, who was at the time Air Chief Marshal Sir Neil Wheeler, a distinguished photographic reconnaissance pilot, Spitfires in World War II. I can't say I was best pleased with the possibility of being shipped off my first squadron after only 9 months on it to go off and be an ADC, but of course I tipped up for the interview, during which Air Chief Marshal Wheeler said, you know, did I want the job? And I said, well, frankly, it's not what I would choose to do at this particular stage of my career, but if you select me, then of course I'll come and do it as well as I can do. And he was kind enough to say, if I select you, I will guarantee that you get a good flying appointment when you finish being an ADC. And he said, to that end, I'll get in touch with the Air Secretary at Barnwood. He also got a couple of other candidates that he was interviewing and so forth. One was a good friend who was a regiment officer. And his office got back to me, I think he may have even come back to me sort of a couple of days later and said that he decided to select the regiment officer, and I'm sure he actually made a wise decision regardless of whether or not he could guarantee me a good flying tour at the end of it. But he did say that not only had the Air Secretary not undertaken to guarantee me a flying tour, but said actually at this stage we can't be sure that there'll be any flying tours at all for Squire. He may have to do a ground tour at the end of it. Because by now, of course, the withdrawal from East of Suez was known about, and therefore there might have been a surplus of air crews and things of that nature. So he said, if I can't guarantee you a flying appointment at the end of being an ADC, I won't take you as an ADC. And I have to say, that was really good news, and I've admired him ever since for that decision, although, as I say, I think he probably did better taking the regiment officer than me in any event. So perhaps he got the best of both worlds. So that, as I say, meant that I saw 2 years through out in Singapore until the disbandment of all the operational squadrons out there, or the three Canberra squadrons and the Hunter squadron, leaving just the Lightning squadron there, with everybody else coming back in the early months of 1970. And I stayed on and sort of helped to pack up the squadron and came back at, say, the back end of February 1970. Having selected myself to an extent as being a volunteer to go to the Central Flying School, I had always known that when I finished my first operational tour, I wanted to go and do something slightly different. I was very happy to go off and be a flying instructor at that stage, although I also had some aspirations to go off and do the ETPS course at Boscombe Down, probably because my father had done the course, but it seemed to me that again that was an important course that one might undertake in terms of, again, further developing your pure flying skills. But then so was the Central Flying School. And I probably recognised, if not then, certainly shortly afterwards, that you couldn't probably do both, not without becoming over-specialised. So I volunteered for the Central Flying School, and sure enough, I was selected, although not without another attempt by the Air Force to make me an ADC. When I came back in February 1970, I was summoned to go and be interviewed for a job as ADC to the Commander-in-Chief of Air Support Command at that stage, whose wife was an invalid. And I could see quite clearly that my job was actually going to be predominantly looking after her, which didn't fill me with enthusiasm. Fortunately, I was able to get out of that because, in answer to a direct question, I said I was actually getting married in October. And the great man said, "Oh, well," he said, "I can't have you if you're getting married." He said, "I won't have a married ADC." So that got me out of that particular job. So I went off to the Central Flying School for the summer of 1970. I was really determined that if I was going to be an instructor, then I wanted to take ab initio pilots, youngsters who really had flown nothing else, and teach them the very early sort of straight and level one and two, turning, climbing, descending, and so forth. And so, as with everybody else, I started on the Jet Provost, which within about a sortie or two reminded me of how really inadequate the Jet Provost was as an aeroplane. It was very good as an instructional platform, but it was really a very underpowered aircraft. People used to talk about it having sort of constant thrust and variable noise. And so within a very short space of time, I decided actually I didn't want to go ab initio instruction, that I would really rather go back to Valley if I could and do the more of the advanced training, flying an aeroplane which was similar to what I had recently flown in the Far East. And so I managed to sort of engineer through contacts and so forth, providing I passed the course or could get myself onto the fast jet side at Central Flying School, then a slot would be kept for me on the Hunter Squadron at Valley. By that stage, there were the NAP still doing advanced flying, but there was also a Hunter Squadron at Valley doing predominantly training for Foreign and Commonwealth students, and more of that later. So having got myself a slot there, I managed to talk the system into taking me off the Jet Provost and putting me onto the NAT at Kemble, which was the outpost of Central Flying School in that area. And I did the most of the instructional course on the NAT, which, again, because of my experience on the NAT when I went through advanced flying training, I didn't find difficult, and I did well on the Central Flying's course. I won all the major trophies on that particular course, including, and this, if you like, was a slightly new development because I'd never really considered myself as being a candidate for it. I won the sort of the aerobatic competition at CFS. Initially for selection to compete in the NAT against the Jet Provost and the Chipmunk or whatever the University Air Squadrons, and we then over Little Risington had a competition where the NAT flew against the Jet Provost and the Chipmunk and so forth, and judges, and it was the Clarkson Trophy, and I managed to sort of bag that, which was the first time that I really ever thought of myself as being perhaps an aerobatic pilot, and that sort of comes into play at a later stage. So a pleasant summer in 1970, at the end of which I did get married at the end of the course. I had always been determined not to marry until I was 25. In those days there were rules which worked against people getting married. First of all, you had to get permission to get married from your commanding officer, but also the financial recompense for getting married did not fully kick into place until you were 25. If you chose to get married under 25, you only got a warrant officer's married allowance. You didn't get any automatic right to quarters and things of that nature. So there were prejudice against getting married. And I had decided that I actually got married 3 days after my 25th birthday, which happened to coincide with the end of the course, and Carolyn and I were married at her home up in Cheshire. We had known each other for quite a long time, actually, because we had met at Cranwell when I was a cadet there, and she was learning to be a teacher at Retford, which wasn't so many miles from Cranwell. We met on a social occasion in 1964, and so it was now 1970, and so we'd known each other for 6 years before we got married, although of course I had served for 2 years in Singapore on the other side of the world, and we hadn't seen each other in that period. But we had really, probably before I went to Singapore in 1968, decided that all things being equal, we were going to marry, and therefore it was just a question of time. And I managed to eke that time out until I was 25 and 3 days. So we were married up in Cheshire and pitched up at Valley again to start about the one of the longer tours that I did in the service, because it was a sort of virtually a full 3 year tour at the end of the day. We lived initially in a small holiday house near Treada Bay, and then we got a married quarter at Tycroyce, which was the trials establishment of the Royal Artillery, where the army was starting to withdraw from to move their operation up to the Outer Hebrides, and therefore this quarter became available some 6 or 8 miles away from Valley, and we grabbed it because we weren't sure that we'd get a quarter on the Valley station itself. And looking back on it, I think we quite enjoyed it. We got to know the army whilst they were there. We were accepted. We became members of their mess as well. It was a nice house, and it did actually put a little bit of an air gap between us and the station. And although we had the journey to and fro, I think it was quite nice in a way. I joined the Hunter Squadron, which, as I say, was predominantly there for doing foreign and Commonwealth training, because many of those air forces, whether they were Singaporean, Kuwaiti, Saudi Arabian, Ecuadorian, all operated Hunters in those days and came to the Royal Air Force to get quite a lot of its flying training done, and therefore it was logical to train them to fly Hunters rather than Nats before they went back to their own air forces. It was also a much better aeroplane for doing foreign and Commonwealth training, where there was almost certainly for some of the students a language difficulty, because English wasn't their first language, and in the Hunter it was side-by-side seating, so you could actually turn and face the youngster and look him in the eye, and he could see what you were doing and you could see what he was doing, which was better than the Nat, which was tandem, where communication was much more difficult and you couldn't see what he was doing and he couldn't see what you were doing. So it was a much better aeroplane. My first students were Singaporeans. They had just bought the aeroplane, and they were really very, very good students indeed, very intelligent. The first young man I taught was going to be a doctor, but because of their national service system and so forth, he got streamed for their air force. But he was a very intelligent young man, very able student and so forth, and most of the Singaporeans were. They were bright, they were keen to learn, worked extremely hard, and their sort of hand and eye coordination and things of that nature were good. Language was good, and so they were ideal students. Some of our students were less well motivated. Language was more of a problem, and they didn't try nearly as hard. But they were a mixture, and there were amongst them all there were some good and some not so good. We flew hard. I was doing sort of on average 400 hours a year, which by any standards is quite a lot of instructional flying per year. One or two people did more, but that was a sort of average. So we were working quite hard, sort of doing on average sort of 2 or 3 sorties a day, with the write-ups and things of that nature to be done afterwards. The Nat one period was grounded for a period of time, and we started to pick up then quite a lot of the UK flying as well. We were expanded, we doubled in size in terms of the number of aeroplanes that we had and the number of instructors we had, and again we were therefore working long hours, weekends and things of that nature to get the task done whilst the NAT was grounded. But it was a fun outfit. We had good chums, and I think, you know, we worked hard and played hard, and as a first tour for married people, it was very nice. We enjoyed the, you know, the outdoor nature of Valley. We enjoyed the fresh air and things of that nature. It was very convenient for us from both our parents' point of view. Karen's parents lived in Cheshire, which was sort of about sort of 2.5 hours away. My parents lived just south of Dublin at that stage, and so again we could get the ferry from Holyhead and go and see them. So from that perspective, Valley was an ideal place.
Can I just ask, does your wife come from a service background? Did she know what she was getting herself in for?
Her father served.